G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanaka on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org. And don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
G'day, Jono.
Great to have you back, my friend. We're just in time for one of Job's so-called friends to, I don't know, he may as well set him alight. Douse him in fuel and set him alight.
So-called friends. The wonderful Bildad. We hear Bildad. His second speech tonight.
There's some interesting stuff in this one, though.
I even posted about that today. It's like really, you know, some head-scratching stuff.
Yeah, really? What, you posted on Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page?
Yeah, it made a mention on Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page that it, it's just the why is Eov so puzzling sometimes?
Uh-huh. Hey, listen, while we're talking about that, though, before we get into Chapter 18, if listeners go to the right-hand side of the website, truthtoyou.org, truth number two, letter u.org, on the right-hand side, there is a link, Treasures from the Tanakh. If you click on that link, it'll take you to the Facebook page. What is this photo, by the way, that we've used for this this button?
So the photo there is the on top of Masada. Masada being the place where the zealots made their final stand against Rome. Mm-hmm. And that is actually the synagogue ruins on Masada. And you'll see kind of the wall to the left and a wall in front of you and kind of some columns there. And if you follow those columns to the back wall there and you make a little right-hand turn, there's a little room in there. And there's actually a sofer, a scribe, that today, as we speak, is sitting in there writing a Torah scroll in one of the most ancient synagogues in the land of Israel.
That is so cool. That is just one of the many photos that you've got on Treasures from the Tanakh. So I would encourage the listeners to click on that. If you're listening right now, perhaps you should right-click on it and open in another tab. But you should click on that one, go there, like the page, and check out the other photos that Ira has there and engage with the information. The Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page. My friend, Chapter 18. Oh, boy. Bildad. I'm going to fly through this. You just stop me when
you
want.
Well, look, at least it doesn't have any descriptions, really. Hairy descriptions of Job's physical condition. So you should be happy about that.
But thanks for reminding me anyway. But it doesn't. It begins like this. It says, then Bildad the Shuite?
Shuhi.
What is it in Shuhi in
Ha-shuhi.
Hebrew? Hashuhi. Answered and said, how long till you put an end to the words? Okay, so we're over the hot air, gas bag sort of thing.
Now but really, calling, we're not.
Well, no, he's calling him a blabbermouth now. He's saying, you're a chatterbox, you're a blabbermouth, you're just speaking these words and you won't shut up. So gain understanding and afterwards we will speak. But that's not true because he's going to weigh in now, even though he thinks that Job has no understanding. Why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? And I suppose he's making reference to what Job said in chapter 12. We go back a little bit and we see, mm-hmm. What is it, 12, 7 and 9? That's right, because Job said in chapter 12, 7, but now ask the beasts and they'll teach you, and the birds of the air, and they'll tell you, or speak to the earth and it'll teach you, and the fish of the sea, and it'll explain it to you. Who among these does not know? And so actually what Job wasn't actually including them as the beasts. He's just saying that the beasts are smarter than his friends.
Pretty much.
So, Bildad, missed that one. But why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or shall the rock be removed from its place?
Okay, so let's just stop there for a second and look at these first four verses. Because in a sense, remember in some of the chapters that we've looked at before, we kind of have this introduction. It seems like we have three or four verses as an introduction, and then we get into the actual meat or the theme of the speech. Mm-hmm. And so here, you know, as we know, we're dealing with this second speech. And it doesn't seem like at this point that the speakers, whether it's Eliphaz or Bildad so far, are necessarily speaking directly to Job. It's almost at this point that we could make the argument of one or two things or three things that basically what they're doing is they're just now presenting an argument. And they could be presenting their argument back to this idea of the divine council, because we know that there was a divine council that took place that set in motion the whole process here. Mm-hmm. But we also made the argument last week that at this point we have to believe that other people have come around. There's been enough time spent where we see these friends staying that people would probably walk by and see, hey, what's going on there?
Look, Ira, this is the reality TV of the day.
Yeah, right? I mean, pretty much.
The whispers around the villages is that, oh, man, you know, this is what happened to Job. Not only that, but these guys, these great other kings have turned up. And they're conversing, and let's go and find out what happened because, you know, and this is good stuff. So, yeah, every day probably quite a few people have sort of gathered at a distance and sort of tuned in.
Right, and so I see these first four verses maybe as speaking directly to Job, but then we get into the meat of it. And what seems to happen here is that Bildad seems to forget that the person sitting before him is a suffering living human being, not only mm-hmm. a suffering living human being, but a suffering living human being that was his close friend. And so when we see chapter 18, verse 2, where he says, you know, when will you put an end to words, or when will you put an end to speech? Consider and after we will speak. We saw this also in chapter 8 in his first speech. It actually starts almost exactly the same in the Hebrew. In 18:2, we see ad ana, and in 8:2 it says ad an. Okay, without the hey there. And in 8:2 it says, "How long will you go on like this, Job, with words that are like hot air," which you referenced. And then in verse 3, in chapter 8, it says, "Will God pervert justice, and will Shaddai pervert righteousness?" And why do we see that? Because we see the connection between these two. We see quite a bit of connection, and we'll look at that as we go a little bit further. And then he says, "Why are we thought of as beasts to be stupid in your eyes?" Which is, you know, how I would translate it. So we see in the first speech that Bildad rebukes him, and why I brought that idea of in 8:3, where it says, "Will God pervert justice, and will Shaddai pervert righteousness?" is because in the first speech we see Bildad rebuking him for a complaint against God, but now it appears that Bildad, like, you know, Eliphaz, is frustrated that Job is completely ignoring what they're telling him.
He's just not acknowledging, as far as they're concerned, he is not acknowledging their rightness, their correctness.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And they're getting frustrated. And, and in this speech here from Bildad, Ira, he's resorting to a bit of the fire and brimstone, really, isn't he?
He is, and he'll actually talk about that later on in the chapter. Yeah. And so in verse 4, when he says, you who tears himself in his anger, will for your sake the earth be abandoned and a rock moved from its place? And so, you know, you kind of look at that and you go, what in the world are they talking about here? And I think that what he's saying is that the same way that he was trying to correct Job in chapter 8 about the way in which God operates, I think what he's saying here is, based on these words, that there's a certain order or providence to the way God operates the world. And he's kind of asking the question, do you expect him now to change that order simply because you're another guy who thinks he's innocent? Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry. Then he goes into the meat of this,
which is, so verse 5, "The lights of the wicked indeed goes out, and the flame of his fire does not shine. The lights is dark in his tent, and his lamp beside him is put out. The steps of his strength are shortened, and his counsel casts him down. For he is cast into a net by his own feet. He walks into a snare. The net takes him by the heel, and the snare lays hold of him. A noose is hidden for him on the ground, and a trap is for him in the road." So we've got trap, we've got snare, we've got net a couple of times, we've got snare a couple of times. He's really emphasizing it. He's basically called Job wicked.
Oh, yeah, he's now just going into a whole dissertation on the wicked. Of course, he believes Job to be wicked, but at this point, I think he's just pontificating to the crowd, and he's just talking about the wicked. So when you look at verse 5 and 6, and this idea of it says also, because then he goes into it, says gam or shaim, also. So he speaks those four verses, and now it starts with also. The light of the wicked will be extinguished, and a spark from his fire will not shine. The light in his tent grows dark, and his lamp above him will be extinguished. I kind of take these two verses together, obviously, because they're saying similar things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you look at the first part of another verse that's also in Job, we see in Job chapter 38, verse 15, it says, "But from the wicked, the light is withheld, and the arm raised to is broken." And we see this concept also expounded in another chapter, in chapter 24, verses 13 through 16. And those verses in 13 to 16, it actually describes the wicked performing different deeds. You know, it talks about a murderer, it talks about a thief, and performing their deeds in the darkness of night. And I think what Bildad is doing here is he's making the argument that night is the blanket of protection for the wicked. In other words, they do all their things at night. The same way that the dawn, you know, the light of dawn is a blanket of the righteous. Their protection is the daylight. And so it's saying here that even he's making the argument that even the dark blanket of protection will be removed from the wicked in those verses, in those two verses. And when we move forward in verse 7, it says his vigorous stride is restricted or hampered. And he
his vigorous stride.
Yeah, his vigorous stride. What do you have for verse 7?
Okay, no, I guess that's kind of the same. I've got the steps of his strength are shortened.
Yeah. Okay. So it's Yitzru Tzadei Ono. His vigorous stride is restricted or hampered, and he casts off his counsel or casts off his advice.
Mm.
And you really this could be contrasted with Mishlei in Proverbs chapter 4, verse 12, where it's talking about the wise person. It says, when you walk, your step won't be hindered, and if you run, you won't stumble. And that's talking about the wise person as opposed to the wicked person.
Sure.
In verse 8, this is where we get into the idea of the net. And read, what did you have for verse 8 again, Jonah?
Well, I've got net. For he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walks into a snare.
He walked into a snare. So what it says there in the Hebrew is ki shulach bereshet beraglav al shivacha yitalach. And so that's an interesting word, the next to last word. I'm sorry, it says sivacha, not shivacha. It's sivacha. Mm-hmm. And so I have, he sends in a net his feet, which is similar to what he said, and upon the network he moves about. Why do I say network? It kind of has this idea of moving around or moving about, has this connotation of him stumbling around, kind of moving to and fro, the wicked, not having a solid path or walking straight. And that the this network, that word sivacha, actually is a similar word used to even the lattice work that was used in building the temple. It's actually talking about a lattice work when you translate it as snare, and that lattice work could be related to kind of the lattice work of branches that somebody would put over a pit, like to snare somebody, to trap somebody,
sure.
where they would take branches and weave them together to kind of look like it's covering up a pit or a net. And that's how that person would get their feet caught in it, stumbling around and getting their feet caught in it.
So are these the same words that are used in verse 9? Because in the English, I've got again, the net takes him by the heel and a snare lays hold of him.
And actually, it's not. There are so many different words that we see for this. And we're going to see it not just as it relates to the snare and the trap, but we also see this later on related to when Bildad gets into the whole idea of very insensitively talking about Job's children again, our offspring. We see several different words. And that's why it becomes sometimes so puzzling when you see it, because you see a word like that, like snare, but unless you look at it in the Hebrew and see how it has this real kind of pictorial language, like the lattice work and kind of making, understanding that. So in verse 9, I have his heel is held in a trap. The snare seizes him.
Uh-huh.
And it is different. It's actually Yochev Ba'akev Pah, and hopefully this thing will be resolved with my eyes. I have an appointment on Tuesday to have some new contacts fitted.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I actually have a corneal disease that requires me to wear not only glasses, but I wear rigid gas-permeable contacts. And what happens is I also have very dry eyes, so what ends up happening is if anything gets under the contacts, I have a hard time seeing, so I have to put things kind of really big. And sometimes it gets a little distorted. So hopefully this will be resolved, and you won't see me stumbling as much over my words in the future.
Hopefully.
But it says you can't
do that. What do you mean something? You know, if something gets under the contact lenses between your
what ends up happening is well, I'm trying, since I can't tell you about Job, I have to tell you about myself.
No, I've got these visions now of like all this sand between your contact lenses and your
right,
eyeball.
So what ends up happening is what I have is called keratoconus, and keratoconus means that my corneas have become cone shaped rather than dome shaped. They're bulging. So they're more shaped like cones. What ends up happening is your eyes don't reflect the light properly because of that. And so the contacts I wear are called Rose K lenses. And what they do is they actually sit in the middle touching my cornea. And because they're small lenses that just sit over the cornea, what ends up happening is if I have any kind of discharge, like if any kind of dirt is in my eye or whatever, or you know, I get any kind of infection, what could happen is, you know, some kind of debris with this type of contact can actually get under the contact and rubs in between the lens of my cornea. And so it actually feels like somebody's sticking a pin or a needle in your eye. Not that I've ever had that happen, but it's
pretty
painful.
For that.
Yeah, it's pretty painful. And so
what you're saying is you've got coney eyeball.
Yeah, so pretty much what ends up happening is this time of night, because it's, you know, it's daytime for you, but it's, you know, starting to get in later in the evening for me. And if I've had my contacts in for quite a bit of time, you know, since early this morning, they start to feel a little gritty in my eyes and so forth. And so it becomes a little bit more difficult to...
Gritty and eyes are two words that shouldn't go together. And so yeah. Just so while we're on the topic, if the listeners would pray for Ira. Ira. If they would pray for him, so hopefully this problem will be rectified on Tuesday, God willing, right?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that these are the contacts that they're trying to fit me with on Tuesday are actually a style that was the first contacts that were ever used created. The style was actually created back in the 1800s. And of course, they've evolved over time, but they're very intimidating because they're actually called scleral lenses. And scleral lenses, your sclera is the white of your eyes. So these are big honking contacts. I mean, these things look like saucers. And what you have to do is you fill them up with, I don't know how to describe it any other way. You fill the bowl up with saline.
No, it's a bowl.
Yeah, it's a bowl. It's like wearing a fish tank on your eyes.
We've got saucers, we've got bowls, we've got fish tank. You're as bad as Bildad.
Yeah, exactly.
So you got swimming pools on your eyeballs. Yeah, keep going.
Exactly. So you fill it up with saline and then you put it on. And because these contacts are, you know, the scleral lenses actually suction on, what ends up happening is nothing can get under them. And the saline kind of keeps your eyes moist. And it vaults the cornea, meaning it doesn't touch my cornea at all. And so it will probably resolve two of the issues, the two main issues, which is the keratoconus and the dry eyes.
So all of this incredible amount of debris that flies into your eyeball down in Florida where you are. Good night, everybody in Florida, and these incredible storms that you suffer. This new swimming pool on your eyeball will protect you from the debris, right?
Sure, seriously. I cannot go to the beach on a windy day. I don't go to the beach anymore for that reason. I can't take a chance of something happening like that. So anyway,
seagull in the eyeball, take you half an hour to get it out. So yeah, I hope
pretty much.
That problem is resolved on Tuesday, because I don't want to hear about grits and eyeballs again. Thank you, Ira. So we've got six. What you're saying is, because 8, 9, and 10, because 10 says a noose is hidden for him, in my translation, a noose is hidden for him on the ground, and a trap is set for him in the road. Are we talking about six different Hebrew words? We've got in eight, I've got net and snare. In nine, I've got net and snare. In 10, I've got noose and trap. Six different Hebrew words?
Oh, we do pretty much, yeah.
Wow, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, and so, but really when it, I consider all of these verses together. Because when you see this idea of verse 9, his heel is held in a trap, the snare seizes him. And then in verse 10, it could actually be translated as snare or noose. And really why that is because it has the idea of something closing in.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like where it says, let's say his noose hides in the earth and his traps upon his path. And so that mm-hmm. speaks to the whole idea of him stumbling around, getting caught in the trap. And it's almost like this idea of the jaws of the trap shutting up on the wicked, or the, mm-hmm. the noose being tightened. And that's sure. where it comes from.
Like a fly in a fly trap. So in, sure. in a spider web. So, but Ira, it changes here, at least in my understanding in the English, it really sort of takes a turn in verse 11. He steps it up a bit, and it's as if he stayed up all night watching a few horror movies, because he gets all fire and brimstone on in fact, I wonder, Ira, if there's a little bit of superstition going on here, maybe some mythical let me read it. This is verse 11.
Okay, yeah. So I don't, but read it. But before you read it, let me just say, see, I think that the idea that we've been talking about ends in verse 11, and then 12 through 17 starts a new theme, and I'll tell you why after you read it.
Okay, so terrors frighten him on every side and drive him to his feet. Now, you think 11 is tied into the noose and the snare and the net.
I do, because it could be translated as all around him, all around he is frightened by sudden terrors, and it could be literally and scatter about his feet or send his feet flying. Mm-hmm. And really what it could mean is that the ground below him is crumbling or breaking to pieces, which could also be related to the trap.
Mm-hmm. And the terrors frighten him on every side, that he's being closed in. What is he being closed in by? Well, I guess from verse 12, this is he has a list. His strength is starved, and destruction is ready at his side. Destruction is ready at his side. It devours patches of his skin. The firstborn of
death.
Oh,
wait a minute. What happened? I thought we weren't going to talk about that.
But destruction is taking chunks out of his skin. It's biting into him. You know, I have visions of like a spider closed to fly up in his net. That the fly was struggling in, and now he's cornered on every side, and now the spider's sunk in his fangs and is doing the job, and it devours patches on his skin. The firstborn of death, Ira.
Wow, you
devours
actually,
his
you
limbs.
Actually
the
have
first,
that.
The firstborn of death. That's what
really?
I've got in my. What do you mean? This is what it says in the Hebrew.
Yeah, that's what it actually says.
Who is the firstborn of death? Where, do we have a cross reference for that?
Holy cow!
It's a holy cow.
If you're a Hindu.
It might be, actually. I might have to look that up. Do we have a cross-reference for the firstborn of death?
We don't. It doesn't appear anywhere else in Scripture.
Do we have a historical Middle East, various other cults and religions, myths and so forth? Is there something for the firstborn of death?
So look, you know, obviously we don't have... we've all been taught about the angel of death, for instance. You know, there's this concept of the angel of death, and people believe that the angel of death came and protected, or killed the Egyptian children and passed over the houses of the Hebrews. Of course, we know that from the Hebrew that it wasn't an angel of death, that Yehovah said he himself would go down. So we don't really see specifically an angel of death talked about, but we see that all through Near Eastern religions, and we see it even within the context of Judaism. But when we see that idea of Bechor Mavet, what it says in the Hebrew, the firstborn of death, that idea of Bechor, or the firstborn, really could simply mean that that it's someone of high standing, that it could be, you could actually translate it as the prince of death. And so from that perspective, in the same way that we're dealing with at the beginning of the Divine Council, a Satan who acts as an adversary, we also have the ability to make the argument like we did with Micheyahu and the idea of the lying spirit that Yehovah allows for a malach to God as a lying spirit to, you know, to Achav, that we also have the potential for there to be a malach that could be sent. As a Malach Elohim or a Malach Yehovah that would act in this way as the firstborn of death.
Sure. But taking into consideration the likeliness, let's say, that the Book of Job is potentially the oldest book in the Tanakh, Mot.
Say again?
M-O-T, Mot. An ancient Middle Eastern god, the god of death. My understanding, understood to be the son of El. Interesting stuff.
Really?
It's just, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I've, and how do I pronounce this? The Ugaritic, Ugaritic Mot, death, is personified as the god of death. It's just interesting that there is, an understanding of that, back in the day of Job. And I wonder if this is something that Bildad has brought with him, and this is part of part of his tradition where he comes from, and he makes reference to this mythical figure.
Yeah, it could very well be. There's no question. I was just kind of looking to see what the rabbis say about this. I was looking to see if I could find anything in particular that would speak to this idea of Bechor Mavet.
It certainly seems to be part of the Ugaritic mythology.
Right. So they make the argument, the sages make the argument that it doesn't seem to connect, that they say the second part of the verse is apparently in opposition to the first part.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, who will consume his body parts? They say body parts because we have that word bade, yochal bade oro. And we talked about this, I think, in a prior show about that word bade, which we translated as alone. I think you even saw that at the end of chapter 17, where he said, "Will I alone go down to Sheol?" And we talked about it being limbs, possibly, or members, you know, members of the body, meaning. Mm-hmm. And so when we see Yochal bade oro, it's talking about his limbs, obviously, that. What I translated is the limbs of his skin are eaten. And the idea that the skin there is really, to me, more talking about the body. That it's obvious that his body is being devoured, and the question is being asked, who is the one that's devouring, you know, his flesh? Who's devouring his body? But the prince of death, or the Chor Mavet. So they say... So this is Rashi. Rashi points out that Bechor, the base meaning of which is firstborn, can also denote someone of high standing, like I said, a prince. And he adduces one of the Psalms, and I looked at that, and I don't see where he adduces it, but that's not a big surprise, where Rambam says the prince of death is the mightiest of all who kill, none can escape him. So from a sage perspective, they're talking potentially of, you know, I believe a messenger that's sent by God to do God's bidding.
There's a couple of perspectives and something for the listeners to look up if you have any comments on that. We'd love to hear it. But he goes on to say in verse 12, his strength is starved. We've got that. His strength is starved. His destruction is ready at his side. It devours patches of his skin. The firstborn of death devours his limbs. He is uprooted from the shelter of his tents, and they parade him before, get this, I've got the king of terrors.
Yep.
What's that in Hebrew? El Melech Balachot.
You did that pretty good. It's Balachot. Le Melech Balachot. And typically Balachot is, Balacha is terror. And so this is terrors. It's the plural. So he's torn from the confidence of his tent, and she will march him to the king of terror.
She?
Yeah. Why do I say that? Because I think there's an allusion there. And so I'm going to make my argument here that when we look at that word...
Because the feminine plural, right, as opposed to im.
Right. And when we look at the verb, for the verb to march, it's Vitatsidehu. And Vitatsidehu starts off in the feminine. It's in the hefil, third feminine singular, to march. So it kind of has this idea of, so why do I say that? Okay. So let's look at this for a second. The first part of the verse tells us that he's torn from the, what do you have? I have, he's torn from the confidence of his tent.
Okay, I've got, and he is uprooted from the shelter of his tent. Yeah, pretty much the same thing, yeah.
Okay, so think about that when you're uprooted from the shelter of your tent. I mean, when you look at this in modern terms, what really is the trust or the confidence of a man's tent but his wife?
True.
But his home, because...
In many ways, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who makes your house in, you know, your house into a home? It's your wife.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it says in Proverbs that a foolish woman tears down her household. She obviously has the power to do that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I look at this verse, what I'm really seeing is that his tent is that he's talking about the fact that the wicked person doesn't have this. You know, the tent should be a place of trust, and I think it's supported in the next verse, actually. Mm-hmm. And remember what Bildad said. Remember when he's bringing this argument now, that he had spoken about the house in chapter 8 in his first speech. In chapter 8, verse 14, he said, whose confidence is fragile and whose trust is the house of a spider. And we talked about that idea of the web and how he talked about the wicked and that the house they build is like the spider web, very fragile. And so basically he's saying that he's going to be torn away from the home in which he placed his trust. And this is where he's really, to me, digging, you know, at Job, at Eov. I mean, it's a really nasty thing to say.
It really is, and it doesn't end there as far as nasty things to say is concerned. And interestingly, Ira, Job does in chapter 19, we'll get there next week, he does mention his wife again, and that's the second time that she'll take a brief step into the limelight. But it goes on to say, so he's uprooted from the shelter of his tent, and they parade him before the king of terrors. But it does say Melech, right? That is king. It's not like a queen. It's the king of terrors.
Right.
The terrors are in the feminine. But they dwell in his tents, who are none of his. Brimstone, Ira, brimstone is scattered on his dwellings. His roots are dried out below, and his branch withers above. The memory of him perishes from the earth, and he has no name among the renowned. Now, if I recall, didn't Job say, and I must have a reference for this somewhere, but he must say, oh, by the way, before I get there, is there any cross-reference for the King of Terrors?
I did not find anything for the King of Terrors either.
I didn't find anything for the King of Terrors either.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing. In any case, Job did make mention at some stage past in his when he was trying to offer some kind of hope to himself because his friends wouldn't, about the dry stump, didn't he? He talked about the dry stump, that at the whiff of water would spring some life and be revived.
Yes, he did.
But even that small, tiny skerrick of hope that Job had to offer, at least for himself, his so-called friend Bildad is pouring on the what do we call that stuff, the stuff that kills weeds, Monsanto, that evil Monsanto. He's pouring on the Roundup on the dry stump.
Yeah. So that was probably, that might have been in chapter 9, because we know that Bildad's first speech was in 8, and he talked about that, you know, this some of the same things. So it could potentially have been in chapter 9, if I remember correctly. But
I'm going to have to find it now. Hang on. I think it is. Oh, sorry. No, it is. It's 14. Job says, though its roots may grow old in the earth and the stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water, it will bud and bring forth branches like a plant. And so on and so forth. But no, we can't have that according to Bildad. So forget that, Job.
Oh, okay. So when I look at verse 15 that you brought up, I translated as she will dwell without him in his tent, and sulfur or brimstone will be scattered on his home. And I connect that with verse 14, the idea of, you know, if we're making this argument about the tent being the place of the home and the wife, you know, being the foundation of that, of building the home, we kind of see this metaphor here, and this idea of the brimstone being scattered on his home really is not literally brimstone being scattered on the home, but it actually is talking about the total destruction of the tranquility of the home that takes place. And then he goes into this very scathing, you know, these very scathing verses, these two verses, you know, which alludes to the children again. His roots beneath him will dry up. Above him, his branch will wither. And remember, he had already mentioned earlier the house that is compared to the fragility of the spider web. And then he also mentions the branches of the garden. We see this in the first speech that he brought in chapter 8, verse 16. He says he is moist. He stays fresh before the sun, and over his garden, his branches go out. And remember, as it relates to that heaping of the stones, he talked about the house as well, that he, that his house will be like the heaping up of stones, talking about the grave, you know, which is the way that, that it ended, chapter 8. Talking about how the godless has his day in the sun when everything seems to be going well. Remember, that was Bildad's argument. Again, like he said in the first speech, that idea of the heaping up of stones. And then it says in verse 17, I have his mention or his memory perishes and no name to him outside. Now, what does that mean, and no name to him outside? It's outside of his tent. In other words, he just talked about the fact that he's not going to have this, you know, he's already talked about the roots beneath him drying up and above him his branches will wither, you know, related to family and this whole idea of the tent and the whole family and the tranquility of the home, that he'll have no branch, no roots, and no one will even speak of him.
And his name will be forgotten. And if there was any doubt about what he is suggesting and what he's reminding Job of in the death of his children and the death of his sons, he goes on to say, to remove all doubt, he is driven from the light into darkness and chased out of the world. He has neither son nor posterity among his people, nor any remaining in his dwellings. Oh, punch below the belt.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and this is where we get into the what I talked about. He uses all these different words for snare and trap before, and then we see the same kind of concept here. He is thrust from light to darkness and put to flight from this world. And that word is from the root to flee or escape, this idea of it being put to flight from this world. And as I said, there are some that believe that verse 12 through 17 is actually a parenthesis. And we talked about that last week, that sometimes it seems like there's a parenthesis, and that this is actually where he gets into verse 18 now, and these last few verses, that it's actually a continuation from verse 11. And it really is like when we're making an argument or we're making a pitch to somebody about something, and we kind of get ahead of ourselves. I think that's what was happening there. I think he got to verse 11, and he wanted to go here next, but then he thought, look, I'm gonna hit this home with these four or five verses here because I want to make my point before I forget. And so when you see this in Hebrew in verse 19, it says Lo nin lo velo neched ba'amo ve'en sarir bimgurav. And so the word nin and the word neched, there both could be translated as offspring, but really I translate it as without descendants and without progeny or offspring. So it's almost saying, guess what? You're not going to have grandchildren. You're not going to have children. You're not going to have nieces and nephews and cousins or anything. No descendants and without any kind of offspring among his people, and there will be no survivor in his sojourning place. That's really important because that last word, Bimegurav, really talks about a temporary abode. It's not like you know, a permanent place.
This is really interesting though, Ira, because what it brings to mind for me is that, and we're going to do 19 next week, but 19 verse 17, Job says, "I am repulsive to the children of my own body," and of course we know that his seven sons and three daughters suffered a death when the tent collapsed and so on and so forth. But it does suggest to me, and I don't know, maybe we'll get into this next week, that perhaps they had children, perhaps he has grandchildren. And if that is the case, what you're telling me here is that Bildad is pronouncing it almost a curse of death upon them as well.
Yeah, it's possible. And remember, he's not necessarily talking directly to Job at this point. He's making a presentation about the wicked and what the wicked can expect. And of course, he's including Job in this, but I don't know that he's necessarily speaking directly to him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, verse 20 is a pretty curious one. I'm not too sure what to make of it. I've got in the English, those in the West are astonished at his day, as those in the East are frightened. What do you make of that?
So I have those who come after will be appalled at his day, just as those there before were seized with horror. And I think really it speaks about that in this idea of him being torn away from his tent, in this idea of him being cast from light into darkness, in this idea that his root will dry up and his branches will wither, and this idea of not having any descendants, not having any progeny, not having any offspring, that basically what's going to happen is in later days, people will be astonished at how the wicked person is viewed in absolute oblivion. It's almost as if the person never existed.
Mm. Well, that reminds me, now there's a prophecy, isn't there? And it's actually quoted in the book of Acts in regards to Judas, that another take his office, that his name be blotted out. And in the context of Acts, it's being applied to Judas Iscariot. Of course, his name wasn't blotted out. But in any case, that's the verse that is going back here.
Yeah. So the other thing that can be said about this verse is that, you know, where it says that those who come after will be appalled at his day, like thinking about all these things that were done, that Bildad is making an argument about, just as these people that are sitting before him now, just as we're sitting before you being seized with horror at how you're being treated because you're just as wicked as the people that I'm describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is Acts chapter 1, verse 20. I know we're treasures from the Tanakh, but it just reminds me of this verse. And in Acts chapter 1, verse 20, it quotes, it says, for it is written in the book of Psalms, and I'll find the cross-reference just a second, it says here, let his dwelling place be desolate, and let no one live in it, and, it goes on to say, let another take his office. And but if we go to those cross-references, it is Psalms, this is in verse 20, so it's Psalm, the first one is Psalm 69:25, so they've actually glued two different references together. Psalm 69, verse 25 says, so 24, pour out your indignation upon them and let your wrathful anger take hold of them. Let their dwelling places be desolate. Let no one live in their tents, for they persecute the ones you have struck and talk of the grief to those you have wounded, and so on and so forth. And the other one, so there's just one phrase that they ripped out of the verse to use there. And the other one was Psalm chapter 109, verse 8. I'm going to go there now. 109, verse 8 says, Ira, well, starting from 7, when he is judged, let him be found guilty, and let his prayer become sin. Let his days be few, and let another take his office. Let his children be fatherless, and his wife a widow. Let his children continually be vagabonds and beg. Let them seek their bread and also their desolate places. Let all creditors seize all that he has, and let strangers plunder his labor. Let there be none to extend mercy on him, nor let there be any to favor his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off, and in the generation following, let their name be blotted out. Wow.
Wow.
And it goes on, you know, let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before Jehovah, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted. It goes on and on and on. And this is a plea for judgment of false accusers from David, if I understand this correctly. And so it's interesting, looking at verses like that, it just reminds me of those particular verses. And there's a lot of truth in what these guys are quoting. They're quoting truths, but they're misapplying the truths. These are misapplied truths, and it's so obvious here in the speech from Bildad.
Yes.
Mm, okay. So, final verse of chapter 18, 21, verse 21, surely such are the dwellings of the wicked. And I mean, he began, didn't he? He began by pretty much calling Job wicked, or at least addressing the wicked and insinuating that Job was such. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him who does not know God.
Wow.
Harsh.
Can you imagine? So it's interesting because it uses a different word here for the dwellings. Actually, it says, Ach ele mishkenot, like the mishkan, mishkenot, tabernacles. Mm-hmm. Only these are the tabernacles or dwellings of the unjust, and this is the place of him who knew not God. And really what this is just, he ends his speech just as he did in his first speech. Because in his first speech, he says, your haters will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more.
Mm.
He makes exactly the same argument.
After all of Job's life, after all the wisdom they've exchanged together, and after, however long they've known him, because of this downfall, and they've judged him as guilty. Why? Because it seems like God is judging him for sin. And because of that, they have made up their mind. They are defending God. They're exalting themselves against Job. And now they're saying, they're announcing to everyone, he doesn't even know God. He's wicked. And he doesn't even know God clearly. All this time he's deceived us. And we thought that he was God's friend, but he's not. He doesn't even know God.
Right.
Doesn't do well in regards to the way that God describes him, Ira, in the beginning of the book. Have you considered my servant Job?
Sure. And especially in light of the fact that they tried to stand in as if they were speaking on behalf of God at one point.
And they're really quite confident that they are.
They are, absolutely. And yet, I don't recall God ever calling them blameless.
No.
Never calling them Ishtab.
As he did with Job.
Sure. But he will be telling them what he thinks of them later on.
We're going to be getting to that, and we'll be enjoying that.
Yeah, we will. We will finally have some fun.
We'll have some fun. But in chapter 19, boy, there are some incredible verses that we are going to explore next week in chapter 19. Very well-known verses. And I'm looking forward to getting to that when Job replies to Bildad. But in the meantime, my friend, that is it. That's chapter 18. We have completed it once again. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on to Truth to You. Treasures from the Tanakh, Torah teacher Ira Michelson. And again, Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page. Get onto the Facebook page. You can go there by going to truthtoyou.org. You'll see it's on the right-hand side, Treasures from the Tanakh. If you click on that button, it will take you there. Like the page and engage with the information, because this isn't the only thing that Ira does. But we thank you for your time, my friend.
Ah, it's always a pleasure. Can't wait till next week.
Always wonderful to have you on. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart for the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.